Thanks again to everyone that's read Optus Open a meeting, and I will take this opportunity to welcome those that have joined us since we first started. A warm welcome to any visitors that might be with us tonight for the first time, and a massive welcome to any newcomers that might be in the room. I hope you're going to hear something that's going to encourage you to keep coming back. Okay, so we are a speaker meeting, and it's going to fall on me tonight to introduce our speaker. So the gentleman that's come along to share with us this evening, actually bumped into in Weston a couple of days ago. We haven't seen each other for a long time, actually, and he's an old friend of Higna, been coming to these meetings for a while. And it's rare for me to be in a position where I can say I've actually met one of you guys in the flesh, and it's a real pleasure. So being ever the opportunity, I jumped on him and asked if he'd be happy to come and share, and he said yes. So, yeah. This man's been through some stuff in his recovery, and I'm really looking forward to hearing his story. We've sort of shared a bit of a journey over the years, and so it's a pleasure to have you with us, Aaron. He's going to share with us for 45 minutes his experience, strength and hope journey into and through Narcotics Anonymous. So the floor is yours, Aaron. Please jump in and share with us, man, however long you're comfortable with. Thank you and welcome.
All right, well, thanks. Thanks, Steve.
Hi, Aaron.
Hiya. I'm Aaron. I'm an addict.
Aaron.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for asking me to share, Steve. If I'm quite honest, whenever anybody asks me to share, my first thought is, what the hell are they asking me for? Do you know? I go in and out of low self-worth. I'm more in it than I'm out of it. But, you know, I can only say what I can say. I can only try and keep calm and hope that the right words come out. I struggle with main shares. I struggle. Do you know, there's odd occasions where I'm sharing off the floor, and it just all kind of comes out as I envisaged it. But I've yet to have that experience doing a main share, if I'm honest. I think the nerves is it kind of gets me on top of the. You know, the little voice in my head telling me that you've got nothing to give these people. They've got better recoveries than you. They've got better, so they can tell their story more coherently. And you know, so I'm kind of fighting addiction. You know, as before I've opened my mouth, and as soon as I start talking, and usually all the way through, that's part of addiction for me. Do you know? Hopefully, these things will change in time as I keep, you know, working on myself using this program. I've just killed a couple of minutes just waffling and trying to, you know, put my excuse in for a bad share before I've even spoken, which is, there's another example of Aaron, the addict. I don't usually get this long to share, which is, it's actually quite nice. Do you know, I've kind of got used to, I do a meeting, another online meeting, most nights, and I do one on the mornings too, and I do service on that one. There's kind of 3 minute time cards, so I've kind of got used to cramming in whatever I think is relevant, and I always get, you know, I always get carded because there's all, you know, 3 minutes. I've just used 3 minutes there, and I've not even said anything yet. Do you know, all you know about me is I'm a bit, I don't know. I'm not quite there, am I? Do you know? Yeah, so I better get into this. It's nice to have a bit more time where I, you know, there'll be times where I'll just probably have to breathe. Just think, right, this, you know, I'll do this. It's not going to kill me. You're not embarrassing yourself. It's not as bad as your head's telling you that it is. You know, it probably does make sense to people, even though you're telling yourself that it's not going to make sense to anyone, but someone who's equally as loony as yourself. So thanks for the extra time. It'd be funny if I got carded on this meeting though with 45 minutes. Wow. Right. I'm pretty sure I'm never going to get asked to share at a convention or anything like that. I just think some people are better at it. Do you know? You know, a lot of the people who I see at conventions, you know, I knew them when they were new in, and they taught just the same then. So I think it's just some people are just that's their thing. They're good public speakers. They can articulate what they mean much better than a lot of us. So all I've got that I think is probably a strength is I've got honesty. You know, I've got a lot of honesty. I find I get more out of the share myself if I can get vulnerable. You know, the more vulnerability and, you know, signs of my imperfections, it seems to help me more. You know, I seem to get more compassion for myself from doing that. I always have trouble knowing where to start with a share. Do you know? I suppose it's a bit like some of these authors who write books. I bet a lot of them, they'll sit there for days just trying to get that first part to like kick you into, you know, what would be a good place to start this, you know. And I kind of have that trouble with shares. You know, I'm 50 years old now, so I'm not, do you know, I'm not a teenager who's just got a short little window to pick experiences from. You know, it goes right back. But I'm also aware that I don't want to sit here and just give you a run through of my every single day of existence on the planet, because it's not gonna help anyone, myself included. I'll try and focus on the stuff that I think's relevant. Do you know, I may go off course now and again, but I will try my best to keep it relevant. Do you know, I know this is about recovery, but I have to mention some things many years before recovery, because without those things, maybe I wouldn't be sitting here now. Maybe I wouldn't be in a fellowship, and maybe I wouldn't feel that my only way of living some kind of normal, worthwhile existence is to live in within a program. Have a program and be around people who can understand me and know the kind of experiences I've been through, you know, and managed to come out the other end somehow. This is going really young because it is relevant. So, you know, I've quite recently done a step four. It was not too long ago, so you know, kind of it was in there. It's good enough for a share because it was relevant enough to go in there. So it's relevant enough to put out there to try and explain why my life went the way it did. You know, I was a really nice, you know, I sometimes think of that kid and think, wow, why couldn't you, Why couldn't you stay that person? Why couldn't you stay that really nice, gentle, inquisitive kid, you know, with funny and, you know, but the, you know, the thing is, I got systematically bullied for about, I'd say about 2 years, you know, and it was kind of any time I went out the door, if I was on my own, if I wasn't with my older brother, there's a local kid. He was good 5 years older than me or something. You know, I was five. He was probably 10 or something like that. And he'd have me doing all these. He'd make me do these impressions. If I didn't do them, he'd beat me up, and it was hell. Do you know when I could I'd escape to woods. I suppose that was my first experience of escaping into another reality to try and get away from the one that I was stuck in. I suppose that was when I started rearranging my character. That innocent kid wasn't helping me to stop getting bullied. He wasn't helping me to stop being constantly scared. And, you know, so I suppose, yeah, that's when I changed. I started spending a lot of time on my own. I'd walk a mile or so to these woods. I don't think you'd get away with it these days, but in the kind of 70s, it was a little bit different. You know, people really did leave their back doors open, and it was a different kind of world back then. Well, I'm still here, so I wasn't abducted and murdered or anything, but I did fall down a manhole on the way there one time, though, and knocked myself out and was found X amount of hours later, and had to get rescued by the fire service. I'd spend a lot of time in those woods, and I loved it. I just loved the safety. I think I just loved knowing that the chances of this boy being in there was practically zero. Do you know? After a couple of years, luckily we moved from that area. My dad took over a news agent's, a good 10 miles away. Far enough away for that no longer to be a problem. But I was a scared kid by the time we were going now. I wasn't that same kid from before that bullying started. Do you know, I'd started building up this persona of myself. You know, I'd try to act confident. I'd try and act tough. Do you know, and I'd do my best to ingratiate myself into the people that, you know, I met along the way. And obviously, you know, all the local tough kids in the new area, it was, you know, they got to know us quickly. You know, my dad and all their parents were coming into the shop, so, you know, it just carried on. I carried on with this persona and went out and doing all crazy stuff with these kids. I say crazy. It wasn't send you to juvenile delinquency prison or anything. It was just, you know, hedge hopping, we used to call it, where we'd just jump over people's hedges and knock door run. And it's probably called something, knock door ginger or whatever it's called where you're from, and climbing on roofs and playing cards in stairwells in flats of blocks, and you know, just kid stuff, really. But you know, a way I found to fit in even more. I started smoking with them. A few of them were smoking, and I tried some, and I started smoking, and then I started stealing cigarettes from mum and dad's shop, and I was taking, you know, giving out cigarettes everywhere, so you know, giving me that feeling of belonging and importance and protection as well, I suppose. Do you know if anyone tried to start, you know, I could be jeopardizing their free cigarettes, I suppose that's what I was thinking. That went on for a while, you know. I became that naughty kid. I did become that naughty kid because it seemed to be working. I wasn't getting bullied. I was fit. I had people around me. I felt protected. And then I skipped on a few years. I had another friend. I'd been caught stealing cigarettes, and well, I hadn't really. They kind of knew. I can't remember them saying, "You've done this," because I was quite good at not getting caught. Do you know, I was quite good at not getting caught. But they knew, because eventually my dad stopped letting me go behind the counter, so I couldn't get to the back room where all the cigarettes were. So all of a sudden, I was a 10-year-old kid with a 3-year habit, and I couldn't get my cigarettes. I went out one day with someone. I can't even remember. It's a friend, but I can't remember exactly who it was. But they said, "Oh, I know someone. They've got this old man lets us go in his flat and smoke, and you know, he lets us smoke a pipe and everything. I thought, oh, this could be the answer. Do you know, it was a couple of miles walk to this person's flat, but I went there, and I went there, and he was giving us cigarettes, letting us smoke a pipe, cigars, and I sitting in the comfy chair. And And I thought, this is it. My problems are all solved. He didn't just want to give us cigarettes, though. Unfortunately, you know, that wasn't his. He wasn't just being nice. You know, like a lot of people tend to want something out of it, and. But I just needed that nicotine even at that young age. So sometimes I was doing it with friends, and it was okay at those times when there was other people there, and the one day my friend wasn't available, and I went there was no one else there, and he let me smoke, and that's the first time he touched me, and I was terrified. I was terrified. I didn't know what to think. But I knew I needed nicotine. I knew I needed, you know, I was kind of, didn't know what was going on, but I was kind of willing to just go because I was getting these cigarettes that I couldn't no longer get, and I kept going back even though that was happening. I went back quite a few times, and that's just how it was at that age. The one day I've gone there, and I've gone in there, and there was another slightly younger boy in the flat as well, sitting on the big comfy chair that I was allowed to sit on and smoke usually, and yeah, um, Yeah, I wasn't getting that attention, and suddenly the cigarettes were running out, and yeah, so that was kind of the end, that was kind of the end of that. But I took the I obviously took this, the shame I felt around it, once it was an end, that's when the shame hit me, and and knowing that something wasn't right about that. But that's okay, as long as I don't tell anyone, as long as that's, I can just keep that to myself. And I think about 10 years later, that man died, and I kind of had a relief. I kind of had a real strong relief that, oh well, that this can die with him. No one needs to know this. You can just get on with your life now. I wish it was that easy. It wasn't though. The life that I'd led from that early age just kept growing. It went from to a lot more serious crime, serious violence, serious abuse. Just no. There was just no real respect there. I had that acting tough thing and multiplied it by a million. It was, suddenly I'm Al Pacino in Scarface. It just spiraled. I ended up spending quite a lot of. I was getting sent to detention centres and young offender institutes, and eventually, and then eventually, I got sent to prisons as well. I got quite a large sentence in a prison, in prison, yeah. I got 9 years on the one big sentence. I ended up being there six for 6 years. I didn't know who I was, and if I thought that I had fear outside, it was nothing compared to, I was in maximum security prisons, around people who are never gonna get out, never. And I had to put that mask on in there and keep it on and never let it slip. For well, I got out, I was in there for 6 years for that. During my time in there, first my dad died while I was in there, and when I'd been in there about a year at that point, and then 6 months later. My mum died when I was, I'd got out to visit her in the hospital. I had like double handcuffs and these chains, and a chain going to this massive secure, we call them screws, but I suppose it's a prison officer. This big massive Scottish prison officer. Yeah, and she died while I was with her. I could only hold her hand because obviously because all the handcuffs and chains and stuff. But yeah, it was. And I was kind of, I was dead inside for a long time after that. But I still. But I still had about 4.5 years to serve at that point, so I couldn't just break down. I couldn't just say, "Oh, I'm really emotional." It doesn't really go down well in those places. I just, just kept it held. I just kept it all inside, all everything. I just kept it all pushed down as much as I could, and just cried in my cellar on the nights, Yeah, I didn't want to be around people. Eventually, I just want to be on my own. I don't want to be around other people. And I did some things to make sure that I was sent down to the segregation for a long time. We call it the block in England. But I was down there for about 6 months. I kind of liked it. I was left on my own. I was given, brought food. I didn't have to sit with people in canteens. And then because of all the madness that I'd done to get myself put there, I was then sent to a maximum security prison. And ended up being in their kind of segregation for 6 weeks before they'd let me up onto normal, and then they put me onto the highest category. Even though I wasn't the highest category, I was category B, and they put me on the category A with all the real gangsters. I had the least amount of time on the whole wing. So I had 9 years, and I was easily the lowest time in there, but that kind of worked for me. Do you know, I didn't have I don't know what it is. They're kind of more grown up. It did help me. Do you know, they were good. I met some good people in there. And I suppose it had been a. After my parents' death and, time alone and just time to heal, I started to feel better and I got that structure. I always kind of like prison for the structure, So I did that anyway. I've got out I'd stopped doing everything. I got really, really well. I'd started writing, fiction and plays and having them performed. I learnt French and, I got really, really proactive in making something different to myself, trying to hit life at a different angle. But as soon as I got released from that maximum security prison, and as soon as I left there, that structure was gone, and those dreams are gone. I had people picking me up in a big fancy car with a really ready-made doobie, and took me for a champagne breakfast, and it just got from the off, it just got really messy. I'd sorted out some drugs from my contacts whilst I was in the prison with there, and I'd sorted my friend at the time who'd also been in on that census, but he'd got out 6 weeks earlier, and when I'd got out and I found out that he'd just been blowing all the money. He'd got himself a mad heroin habit, and he just blew all this money that I owed to these other people. So kind of within a couple of days, I'm having to go up into the middle of Birmingham, meet up with these people, buying heroin, taking it back and distributing this stuff. And I was driving illegally. Everything that could have just got me thrown straight back in, I was doing, and my experience is when I work around drugs, I end up using drugs, and that's exactly what happened. I got my own habit, I paid off those debts somehow, but I'd also picked up a mad habit myself, and I carried on doing those mad things not to pay bills, and then just to pay my own pay for my own addiction. There's more stuff that I could go into in between that stuff, but There's no real need. I was broken. I did a detox with not with any drugs or anything. I'd got into if you could call it relationship with a girl. Don't really think you could call it. I don't know what it was, you know, but you know, we were kind of friends, and I lived in her flat and I just kind of went cold turkey, and she'd just be putting dry towels on me, which would be wet within minutes. And, somehow I did it. And, and it doesn't take that too long for me to be clean and then think that, oh, everything's all right now. And I did it again. I got my own flat over there. I built up, I'd gone to training courses and got my license for telescopic forklifts on building sites. I'd started writing again and I even got an award. I got an award for one of my poems. That's my MO. I'll get things going okay. I'll rebuild some things, and then I'll have that bright idea but I could do with more money, and I know how to make money. Do you know, my friend's got some of that stuff, and I could sell that, and with a profit, I could do this. So I set it off again, That was a big relapse for me, because I discovered crack cocaine. I was doing big drug deals, but by this time, I wasn't doing little street deals anymore. I was getting kilos, and I was distributing a lot. So I had a lot of money. I had lots of cannabis grow rooms and different properties all over the city. From the outside, it looked like I was really doing well, but that crack, and it didn't start with crack. I didn't think, I'll phone a crack dealer and get some crack. I was getting this cocaine, and to test it, we'd wash a little bit up, and to see kind of the purity of it, and the one day, my friend who I did that washing with, he just left it there. He said, oh, I don't want that, just do what you want with it. And obviously I smoked it, and I could not stop smoking then. I could not stop smoking for about 4 years. It was a daily thing for 4 years. Not just, eventually I couldn't be bothered washing stuff up. I'd be phoning them and getting them to drop me stuff off. All my business, all the things that I'd set up, all the, my criminal enterprises, they all started, breaking down and disappearing. I got really lost. Eventually, I owed the people I've been getting the drugs from. I'm owing them money, I'm hearing they're coming down looking for me, and with all sorts. I think they probably had a nice space in the boot of their car for me. I'm pretty certain of that. I just disappeared. There's lots of things in here that I'm kind of glossing over, because there just really wouldn't be time, I'd got with girls in these periods as well, and I'd made their lives misery. I just brought misery and hurt, because my selfishness has there is no bounds to where that selfishness can go. There's got no limits. And that was kind of not just relationships with me, but it was just anybody who got in touch, in contact with me, anybody who, was near me, they would get hurt because they weren't the most important person. What their needs weren't greater than mine, and what they felt couldn't surpass what I was feeling as. Well, that ended with me in a hostel with my dog. Didn't mention my dog before. I had a nice little red Staffy. The only thing I had left at the end of that using, even though I can remember counting nearly £500,000 in cash several years before, all I had was the clothes on my back and this dog. And I was sitting in a hostel that allowed to have dogs in the center of Birmingham, and I just wanted to kill myself all the time. I really did, I had flimsy attempts a couple of times, but that feeling was with me every single day. I just couldn't understand how I could have caused so much destruction. How I can just push everything good in my life away from me. I didn't understand myself. Whilst in that hostel, there was another lad in there. I'd known him years before. I think we used to do certain crimes together. And he said he was going to go to an NA meeting, whatever that was. And he asked if I wanted to go. And to be honest, I just wanted to get out of the hostel. I just wanted to get out. I was in there, sitting there, and spending more time in my head than I was with anyone else. And I just thought it'd be good just to get out. And I've gone to this meeting, and can't remember much. I can remember feeling really uncomfortable when men were coming over and hugging me. I remember that part. I remember feeling, when they gave me a cup of tea, that what they after here. And obviously I was thinking, is it a cult? But that's kind of all I remember. I don't really remember any share. I just remember the hugs, really. I remember that I was actually being welcomed. Whether I believed that was sincere or not, I can't say, but I do know that something must have changed. I'd had a joint of this weed on the way there, and I still had like a £10 bag of this weed, and my plan was to smoke some on the way back, and then smoke, and I didn't do it. I sold that for a tenner because I was obviously destitute, so I couldn't really just say, oh, I'll just throw that £10 away, even though I've got no body wash or toothpaste. And I kept doing that. I kept going to those meetings, not knowing what for, really, apart from it was getting me out of that environment in the hostel. And I just kept going. I was still taking subbies at that point, and I think I got to 30. I got 30 days without using any street drugs, and I thought, yeah, this is the day. This is the day I pick up my orange keyring. This is epic. God, look how well I've done. And somebody pointed out that you're on Subutex, aren't you? Yeah. That's not drugs, though, is it? Wow. Yeah, it is really. You're not actually clean, and I was quite offended. How dare you? Don't you know how difficult this has been for me to do this, to keep coming to these meetings, to take on these washing up roles, and not kill all you people. Don't you understand what I've done? But he was right, because Once I did get off that Subutex and things settled in my mind, I could tell the difference. I could tell the difference between how I was looking at life at that point and how I started to view the world around me when I didn't have any substances in my system. And I started, you know, I got my spot and I did all the suggested things. I got a sponsor. I started working the steps. I was doing meetings every day. Sometimes I'd walk, you know, five miles in the snow if I had to, you know. I had a real desire because I'd managed to stay clean and things were, you know, I'd enrolled in college and I'd started doing this software development course, which led on to a degree. And, you know, I just putting weight back on and, you know, I just, I started that rebuilding thing, but clean this time. Yeah, and it was good. It was going well. It was going well for about 5 years. I started taking on different kinds of service. You know, I did a lot of PI. I ended up being the chair of PI in the West Midlands region, and I kind of started thinking I've got this cracked, and started believing my own bullshit and thinking that. No, I reckon I can do it. I reckon I could do it now. I've got all these tools I've learned, and that's when it all started unraveling. Really, you know, I got with a girl who I ended up having a daughter with. She lived in the town where I grew up, which is like 20 miles outside Birmingham. So I gave up my flat, moved over there. I kind of disconnected from everything to do with recovery. I changed my Facebook profile, changed my phone number. I did everything I could to keep myself away from that life, because I'm going to build this new life that's going to be fantastic, because I've got all these learnt tools that I can use along the way. I'm not going to use now. I haven't used for years, so I'm obviously not going to use now. But that wasn't the reality. That's not how it went down. Do you know? I got this saying off my sponsor, and I don't know where. I'm sure he got it from somewhere else as well. But I then proceeded to check in to the Department of Bright Ideas, and I'm great at those, you know. No, I really am, you know. My friend's got a pub over there, and it starts with okay, I'll just help him set some pool teams up, and then I do that, and after a while I think, well, you know, I start playing a lot more pool like I used to, and started playing like county level and stuff, so I'm having to practice a lot, and I'm thinking, well, if I get a job in there on a quiet night, I'm going to have plenty of time to practice, and I'm also going to get money. So I'm someone 5 years clean, with no program, working as a barman in a pub, and as you can imagine, it didn't take long for me to get to the point where I thought that, you know, that pint with that little dash of lemonade in the top, that's not going to hurt if I just have one of those a week or something, you know, once a week, that won't hurt. And yeah, unfortunately it did the damage, because it progressed, you know, that it to everything, and eventually five years down the line, I was back in that room washing up coke, crying, not wanting to smoke that one I've just washed up, and wishing I was dead. Do you know, I'd pushed everything away. I'd been kicked out of my family home. I'd lost. I'd hurt everyone around me again. I owed my best friends who I'd grown up with. I'd hurt them, and you know, took the money, and I was just in that same place. Do you know? Yeah, And I still didn't think it was because I'd stopped doing recovery. I didn't really think that at that point. I just thought, oh, you just made some silly mistakes there. But it wasn't. You know, I came down to the West Country at that point. You know, I owed lots of people money. I had a big bag of drugs of other people's. And my plan was to sell this big bag of drugs, to put even more money with the money that I had, and go off to Spain, because it's all going to be different there. Another one of my Department of Bright Ideas. Do you know? But luckily, I just thought, there's something really familiar about this. There's something not right. And I thought, you know what, I just looked through my phone, and I had the same chip, I suppose, in this phone. And I went through numbers, and I saw a number with someone I was in recovery with in the Birmingham Fellowship. And I thought, I wonder. And I didn't think it'd still be on that number, but I phoned. And he answered, and I just got real. I just said, I've fucked up. I'd actually managed to get about a week clean at that point, because I'd gone to some meetings in Taunton where I was at that point. And I just said, I'm planning on going to Spain, but I'm thinking it might be a bad idea. Can you do anything? And he got in touch with someone down here in Weston, and who was kind of manager of some dry houses. And said, yeah, I've been in touch, and you can get in there. You've got a week clean. You can get in there on Monday. So yeah, I came over here on the Monday. Met up with my friend who's now my sponsor, by the way. He's been my sponsor for quite a few years now, and I kind of jumped in. But I, you know, the first year or two, I was kind of doing it the same way I was doing it when I first got clean in Birmingham. After a while, I'd be dropping stuff out, and you know, I was just staying clean. I wasn't recovering. I will be able to finish this. How long have I been going on? Wow. I've been going on longer than...
Oh, you're good, man.
I will try and wrap this up as quick as I can now. So I'm just going to fast forward to... I was over 5 years clean just before Christmas. Just gone, and the girl I'd been with for nearly 6 years, she broke up with me, and this is when this is what it took for me to actually get into recovery. Even though my clean time might say that I'm a certain amount of recovery, I'm not. Do you know my real recovery started. Just after Christmas, I'd say that's when it started. You know, I started on my step work, and I reached out to people, something that I'd never do before. You know, I never would. I always thought that I could get my way out of this situation. I could think my way out of this, or I could hold on, and I don't need anyone's help. But I didn't do. I knew that I couldn't do that. You know, it hadn't worked for me all this time. So why would it work now? So I've reached out to people. I've hooked onto lots of meetings, both face to face and on Zoom. I usually do like 3 meetings a day, and I'm still doing that now, even though I'm not as much pain as I was when that breakup first happened. You know, and I got into the steps again. I'm on step six now, and I do think that I've been working it to the very best of my ability. You know, I've been very thorough. There's been stuff come out in my step four that I hadn't put in previous step fours. You know, because I'm just no longer willing to just go along in life and just be clean. You know, I need to if there's a chance for me, I know it's in the steps. I know it's in changing the way I view the world into something more like I viewed the world before that first round of bullying I got as a kid. Because I do believe he's in there. He's in there somewhere. You know, I know I'm not a bad person, even though my head can tell me I am a lot of the time. I know if I can just keep chipping away and keep doing the right thing, and I'll be able to find something in me that will help to make my life a lot better. I'm just a work in progress. That's all I am. I'm just an addict. I care about my own recovery and I care about other people's recovery. I've got time for people, and I don't mind. Whatever it takes to stay in recovery and to feel a part of, and to, I'm willing to do it. I've got a system in the morning now. That was missing. The spiritual side was missing. That was the big piece of the jigsaw that was missing. Now that is part of my daily thing now. So that's how I start my day, and it seems to be helping. I tend to have better days when I start the day properly. And I get my mind in the right place to accept what I need to do to get through this day clean and to go forward in my recovery instead of falling back. I think I'll leave it there, Steve. Sorry if I've gone on a bit. Thanks for letting me share.